The shot, when it came, was a puny little pop of sound, muted by the wind, and the long spurt of grey powder smoke was whipped away almost before it could form. Though they were all watching avidly through the telescopes, not one of them could spot the fall of shot, and Denham spoke aloud for all of them. "She's not altering, she's ignoring us." "Very well," Clinton kept his voice low. "We'll try one into her rigging." The 16-pounder banged again, like an unlatched door in a high wind. And this time they both exclaimed in unison. A pinprick of light appeared in one of the Huron's studding sails, pierced by shot. It held its shape for an instant and then burst like a paper packet and was blown to tatters. Clinton saw the bustle of Huron seamen on the decks and yards, and before the bow chaser could be reloaded, the ruined sail was hauled down and another clean new sail spread open in its place. The speed with which the sail change was made impressed even Clinton. "The devil is a good sailor, I'll grant him that." And then he broke off. For Huron was turning boldly, seeming to aim to cut the gunboat's bows. And Clinton realized what her captain was doing. He was anticipating the rush of the wind, and as Clinton watched, it struck her. It came roaring aboard the clipper, howling through her rigging like a pack of hunting wolves, and the tall ship heeled and seemed almost to crouch, gathering herself like a blood stallion, feeling the cut of the lash, and then she hurled herself forward and was away. The dark, wind-scoured sea burst open before the long, lithe, knifing howl, and joyously Huron tossed the dashing white spray over her bows. "She's making 20 knots, Denham cried with disbelief, as Black Joke seemed to come up dead in the water, a wallowing log when compared to the swift and lovely ship that cut daringly across her bows, just out of cannon shot, and dashed away into the open Atlantic Ocean. Through his glass, Clinton saw that the seamen who lined Huron's yards were gambling and waving their caps, mouths wide open, and they cheered and jeered, and then he focused the glass on Huron's deck. There was a tall figure at Huron's near rail, clad in a plain dark blue jacket. Clinton could not make out the man's features at this distance, but he recognized the set of wide shoulders, the arrogant carriage of head that he had last seen over the sights of a dueling pistol. The acid bile of hatred rose to scald his throat as the figure lifted a hand in a laconic salute, a taunting gesture of farewell, and then turned away from the rail unhurriedly. Clinton snapped his telescope closed. "Stern chase," he ordered. "We'll keep after her." He did not dare look at his officers' faces, lest one of them wore an expression of pity. Lying on her bunk, her arms held stiffly at her sides and hands clenched painfully, Robin heard the creak and squeal from the deck below her that meant Huron was altering course and that the 8-inch thick rudder lines were running through their blocks as the helmsman spun the wheel. It was a sound she had long become accustomed to, and she braced herself instinctively as the rudder lines attached to the pintles trained around the enormous wooden rudder under Huron's stern, and the ship altered her action through the water. Seconds later, there was a thunderous commotion from the deck above her, the blustering roar of the gale socking into the rigging, the crash of tackle coming up taut, the slam of the great sails as their awesome power was transferred into the hull, and Robin was almost hurled from her bunk as Huron heeled wildly. Then the cabin was filled with the exultant thrumming of the hull through water, as though she were the body of a violin, as the bow were drawn across the bass strings, and Huron trembled with life, lifting and dropping to the new urgency of her run. Very faintly, Robin could hear above it all the sound of men cheering. She jumped from the bunk and, clutching for handholds, crossed the cabin and pounded her fist upon the door. "Nathaniel," she called, "answer me this instant. Captain says as how I'm not to talk to you." His voice was muffled. "You cannot torment me so," Robin yelled back. "What's happening?" A long pause, while Nathaniel considered his duty, and then weighed it against his affection for this spirited young woman. "We are on the wind, ma'am," he told her at last, and going like all the devils of hell with a crackerjack tied to her tails. "What of Black Joke?" she pleaded. "What of the British gunboat? Ain't nothing'll catch us now. Reckon the Puffing Billy will be out of sight before nightfall. From here she looks like she's dropped her anchor." Slowly Robin leaned forward until her forehead pressed against the planking of the door. She closed her eyes very tightly and tried to fight down the black waves of despair that threatened to overwhelm her. She stayed like that for a long time until Nathaniel's voice roused her. It was rough with concern. "Are you all right then, missus?"
"Yes, yes, thank you, Nathaniel. I'm just fine," she replied tightly, without opening her eyes. "I'm going to take a little nap now. Don't let anybody disturb me."
"I'll be right here, missus. Ain't nobody going to get past me," he assured her. She opened her eyes and went back to the bunk, and knelt before it and began to pray. But for once she could not concentrate. Jumbled images kept intervening. And when she closed her eyes, the face of Clinton Codrington was there, with those pale, beautiful eyes, in the darkly tanned mahogany of his face that accentuated the sun-bleached platinum of his hair. She longed for him, as she had never done before. He had become a symbol for her that was good and clean and right. Then her mind darted away, and it was that distant, mocking smile, the taunting, gold-flecked eyes of Mungo St. John. She trembled with humiliation. The man who had violated her and turned her own emotions traitor, who had dallied with her and allowed her to hope, nay, to pray, that she could bear his children and become his wife. Her despair turned to hatred once again, and hatred armed her. "Forgive me, Lord. I'll pray later. But now I have to do something." She started to her feet, and the cramped little cabin was a cage, suffocating and unbearable. She hammered her fists on the door, and Nathaniel replied immediately. "Nathaniel, I cannot bear it in here a moment longer," she cried. "You must let me out." His voice was regretful but firm. "Can't do that, missus. Teepu would have a look at my backbone." She flung away from the door, angry, confused, her mind in a turmoil. "I cannot let him carry me away. I can't..." She did not go on, for she could not imagine what awaited her at the end of this voyage, unless... And she had a vivid mental image of Huron coming into dock, while standing on the quay was a beautiful, tall and aristocratic French woman in crinolines and velvets and pearls, with three small sons standing at her side, waving up at the tall, arrogant figure on Huron's quarter-deck. She tried to close her mind to it, and she concentrated instead on the sound that Huron made as she bore away joyously on the wind. The drumming of her howl and the pop and creak of her planking, the clatter of tackle and the stamp of bare feet on her deck as a party of seamen walked away with a fall, training one of the yards more finely to the wind. From beneath her feet came another muted squeal, like a rat in the cat's jaws, as the helmsman made a small adjustment to Huron's heading, and the rudder tackle ran protestingly through the blocks. The sound triggered a memory, and Robin froze, trembling again, but this time with anticipation. She remembered Clinton Codrington describing to her how, as a young lieutenant, he had been in command of a cutting-out party sent into a river estuary that was crammed with small slaving craft, bugaloos and dhows. "I didn't have enough men to take them all as prize at once, so we jumped from one to the other, cut their rudder lines, and left them drifting helplessly until we could pick them up later. Those that hadn't gone aground, that is." Robin roused herself from the memory and rushed to the corner of her cabin. She had to wedge her back against the bulkhead and push with both her feet to move her wooden chest into the centre of the cabin. Then she dropped to her hands and knees. There was a small trapdoor in the deck, so neatly fitted that its joints were knife edges. But there was a small iron ring, let flush into the woodwork. Once, on the long voyage down the Atlantic, she had been disturbed by a very apologetic carpenter's mate, and she had watched with interest while he had dragged her chest aside and opened the hatch to descend through it with a grease pot. She tried now to open it, but the hatch was so tight-fitting that it resisted her efforts. She snatched a woolen shawl from her chest and threaded it through the iron ring. Now she could get a fairer purchase. Once more she strained back, and the hatch moved inchingly, and then abruptly flew open with a crash that she was sure must have alerted Nathaniel. She froze again, listening for a half minute, but there was no sound from beyond the cabin door. On her hands and knees again, she peered into the open hatchway. There was a faint breeze of air coming up out of the dark square hole, and she could smell the thick grease, the reek of the bilges, and the awful slave stink that not all the lye and scrubbing had been able to cleanse. Her gorge rose at the taint. As her eyes adjusted, she made out the low and narrow tunnel that housed Huron's steering gear. It was just high enough for a man to crawl along, running fore and aft along the hull. The rudder lines came down from the deck above, ran through heavy iron blocks bolted into one of Huron's mainframes, and then changed direction and ran directly astern down the narrow wooden tunnel. The pulley wheels of the blocks were caked with black grease, and the rudder lines were of new yellow hemp. They seemed as thick as a man's leg, and she could sense the enormous strain on them, for they were as rigid as steel bars. She looked around for a means of damaging them, a knife, one of her scalpels, perhaps, and almost immediately realized the futility of anything so puny. Even a strong man with a double-headed axe would be hard-pressed to hack his way through those cables, and there was no room in which to swing an axe in that narrow tunnel. Even if a man had succeeded in severing one of them, he would have been cut to bloody tatters as the cable whiplashed. There was only one means, one sure means, and she quailed at the thought of what would happen if it got out of control, and if Black Joke was not very swiftly alongside to render assistance with her steam-driven pumps and hoses. She had once already rejected the idea of using fire, but now with help so close astern, with the last chance rapidly fading, she was ready to accept any risk. She reached across and pulled off the wooden bunk one of her grey woolen blankets and wadded it into a bundle. Then she stood up and lifted the oil lamp from its gimbals in the deck above her. Her fingers were clumsy with haste as she unscrewed the cap of the oil reservoir in the base of the lamp. She soaked the blanket, and then looked round for anything else that was inflammable. Her journals? No, not them. But she pulled her medical manuals out of the chest and ripped the pages out of them, crumpling them so that they would burn more readily, and she made a sack of the oil-soaked blanket and wadded the paper into it. She stuffed it down the hatch, and it fell across the straining rudder lines and entangled itself in the iron pulleys. The mattress on the bunk was filled with coir. The dry coconut fibre would burn fiercely. She dragged it off the bunk and pushed it into the hatch. Then the wooden slats off the bunk followed it. Then the navigational books from the narrow bookshelf behind the door. She looked about her swiftly, but there was nothing else in the cabin that would burn. The first swan vesta that she dropped burning down the hatchway flickered once and then went out. She tore the end sheet out of her journal and twisted it into a spill. When it was blazing strongly, she let it fall into the dark square opening, and as it floated down, it illuminated the gloomy recesses of Huron's bilges and the rough planking of her underbelly. The burning spill landed on the oil-soaked blanket, and pale blue flames fluttered over it as the evaporating gases flashed off. Then a crumpled ball of paper caught, and little orange flames peaked up and danced merrily over the blanket and the linen covering of the mattress. A rush of heat came up through the hatchway, scorching Robin's cheeks, and the sound of the flames was higher than that of the rushing seas along the outside of the hull. Using all her strength, Robin swung the hatch cover over and let it drop back onto its seating, with a thump that alarmed her anew, but immediately the sound of the flames was cut off. Panting with the effort and a savage excitement, Robin backed away and leaned against the bulkhead to rest. Her heart was pounding so fiercely that the blood in her ears nearly deafened her, and suddenly she was afraid. What if Black Joke had abandoned the unequal contest? And there was nobody to rescue the 800 miserable souls chained below Huron's decks before the flames reached them. That first wild assault of the wind, as it came boiling down off the mountains, had settled to a steady blast, not so furious, but constant and reliable. "There'll be no flukes or holes in this gale of wind," Mungo thought with satisfaction, pausing in his pacing to look up at the small, scudding, wind-torn shreds of cloud that seemed to scrape the tops of his masts, and then turning to survey an indigo Atlantic that stretched to every corner of the horizon, dark with the wind rush and dappled with the prancing white horses that curled from every wave crest. His leisurely survey ended over Huron's stern rail. The land was already out of sight, so swiftly had Huron run the great flat-topped mountain below the horizon, and Black Joke was hull down. Only her topsails showed, not a trace of furnace smoke. The absence of smoke puzzled Mungo a little, and he frowned, considering it, and finding no plausible answer, he shrugged and resumed his pacing. Black Joke would be out of sight, even from Huron's towering masthead, before sunset, and Mungo was planning the evolutions he would make during the night to confuse thoroughly any pursuit before settling onto his final course to run through the doldrums and across the equator. "Deck! Masthead!" A faint hail reached him, breaking his line of thought, and he stopped again, threw back his head, and with both hands on his hips stared up at the masthead as it dipped and swung across the sky. Tipu answered the hail with a bull bellow, and the lookout's voice was strained, his anxiety evident even against the wind, and at that remove. "Smoke!" "Where away?" Tipu's voice was angry. The reply should have given both distance and bearing from Huron. Already every man on Huron's deck was twisting his head to sweep the horizon. "Dead astern!" "Oh, that'll be the gunboat," Mungo thought comfortably. "She's got her boiler going again, and much good may it do her."